This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 98.
Hello and welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk with Dr. Tim Noakes, a world-renowned research scientist, author, and lecturer in exercise physiology. And for this episode's quick tip, we tell you about a subscription-based box for runners. And to make 2014 the year you get in the best shape of your life, find out how to become a member of the Academy or sign up for personalized coaching with Angie by visiting our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. So, Angie, did you get your workout in today or what?
I did, yes. Good. I actually ran 5 miles on the treadmill at the YMCA and then...
That's sort of fun.
Did some lower body weights, lunges, squats, etc.
My attention span is too short to handle the treadmill.
Yeah, I don't really enjoy it that much either, but I was watching TV while I ran and flipping between channels. I have to play with the incline usually and the speed and... bump things up, because if I just try to run at one speed for several miles, I get really bored.
I feel bad for those people that do their long runs on the treadmill.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have probably been putting in treadmill time recently with this cold vortex that has hit the United States and possibly other areas.
Well, I admire those people.
That's right. Whatever it takes to get your workout in, do it.
That's right. You're awesome.
It takes a special kind of mental discipline to put in treadmill time.
Yes, you got to feel good about that, definitely. So what else is going on, Angie? We're coming up on the 4-year anniversary of MTA. That'll coincide with our 100th episode, actually. So it doesn't seem like it's been 4 years, does it?
In some ways it does, but it's been a great 4 years. It's gone very fast.
Yes.
And it's been a lot of fun, a lot of work, but definitely very rewarding.
Yes, it has. We are so thankful for all of you who are listening to this podcast and all of you who have been customers and all of you that are in the Academy going through the training and coaching clients of Angie and everybody that makes this possible. And we're looking forward to an awesome 2014. We've got some great content planned. We are almost at episode 100, and we've been thinking about how to make kind of a special event around this episode. And one idea that we had was people can call in and leave us a question that we can play on the podcast and answer the question. So do a big Q&A episode. In order to accomplish that, we have a SpeakPipe account set up. If you go to our website, you'll see on the right-hand side of the page, there's a little box. It's a SpeakPipe box that will enable you to leave a voicemail for us right there on our website. All it takes is your computer or your phone. It won't cost you anything, and we'll have a recording of your voice, and we'll be able to play that and your question on episode 100. So does that sound like a good plan or what, Angie?
Of course.
Well, pretty soon we're going to be going to the Myrtle Beach Marathon. It's on February the 15th. Are you ready for that or what?
I'm getting ready, and I'm excited.
Yes, I'm trying to get ready too. And we're going to have a epic MTA meetup down there. We're going to meet after the marathon for dinner between 5 and 7 o'clock at a seafood restaurant, seafood buffet. I think the seafood will be pretty authentic at Myrtle Beach, don't you think?
I should hope so.
They're not shipping it in from anywhere, so this is going to be great. And we'd like to meet you there. If you're going to be at the Myrtle Beach Marathon, send me an email, and we will plan on having a space for you there. My email address you can reach me at is trevor@marathontrainacademy.com. What else is going on, Angie?
Well, I've got a few shout-outs to read. The first one comes from Jason. He says, "Hi, Trevor and Angie. I'm a big fan of the podcast. I've been listening since episode 3. And I wanted to share my recent marathon experience with both of you. I was actually not planning on running any marathons for 2013. By June, though, my feet were begging to go out for longer runs. I quickly couldn't help myself and looked for any interesting marathons. I found a double marathon near me in Allen, Texas on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. And this was right before I heard you say on the podcast about double marathons. I decided to do the full marathon on New Year's Eve and the half on New Year's Day. The New Year's Eve race was a picture-perfect day weather-wise for a race. The route was an out-and-back, which meant we had to run the same route four times. The other difficulty was the course was a nice paved trail, but it was only four people wide. While this slowed things down for me, it was great seeing all the amazing runners and cheering them on multiple times. I hit the wall going into my last lap. Thoughts of, I have to do this again tomorrow, kept creeping in. However, Angie's tip in the last podcast about playing a game of how many people you can pass and gain points really helped. I ended up with plus 8 points. Finally, on New Year's Day, I was going to take it easy and see it as a victory lap. I was thankful I only had 2 laps instead of 4. At about mile 4, I met a husband and wife that kept me company through mile 8 when I left them, and I felt really strong. I had the feeling that I could do anything when I finished today. This was my 4th marathon and 4th half marathon so far. I want to thank you both for your podcast and website. Can't wait to see you both reach the 100 podcast episode milestone. God bless, Jason.
Well, thank you, Jason, for sending in that race report, and congratulations on completing another marathon. It sounded like it was a tough one, but another marathon and a half marathon, a double of sorts in the books for him. That's awesome.
That's right. I just got this email today from one of my coaching clients, Kathy from Ohio. She's down in Florida doing the Disney World Dopey Challenge, which is a 5K one day, a 10K the next day, a half marathon the next day, and the full marathon.
So that's like 4 days in a row of running.
That's right. 4 days in a row of racing.
That's awesome.
She says, I just wanted to let you know how it's going. I finished the 5K and 10K so far. The weather has been hot and humid. Tomorrow is supposed to be super hot, so thankfully it's just the half. I'm going to take it slow and save my legs for the marathon on Sunday. I have to thank you for helping me get here. I was so worried that having 62 days to get ready for this wasn't enough time. You helped me change my nervousness into confidence. I will never suggest someone get ready for this race in that short a time. She says, LOL. Thanks for all you do to help build runners into strong finishers. There is no doubt in my mind that I will finish with a smile on Sunday.
Well, that's awesome. We look forward to hearing her report on Sunday.
Definitely.
And wouldn't that be fun to do, that Dopey Challenge?
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yes, we were going to make it down to Disney World with our family one of these days and do that awesome marathon down there and take our kids to the park and shell out thousands of dollars and everything that families do. But congratulations, Kathy. We're proud of you, and we know you're going to do great.
That's right. And we got this note on our Facebook page from Gary. He said, I just caught up with your Rocket City Marathon recap. Trevor, sorry about the stomach issues. If you check out the Generation UCAN website, they do not encourage sipping the product as you would most sports drinks. They suggest 30 to 45 minutes before the race and then possibly another full drink after about 2 hours of running. Maybe this had something to do with your issues. Better luck next time. And I also received an email from one of my coaching clients, Karen, saying nearly the same thing. So,
yes, that's very helpful to know. Thank you for that tip, Gary and Karen. And you're right, I was sipping the UCAN the whole time. I was somehow didn't read the label carefully enough. And that could have been why I got sick to my stomach. And I'm definitely going to try it differently next time. And for those of you that didn't hear the Rocket City Marathon recap, I think it was episode 96. I ran one of my slowest marathons ever and had stomach issues, nausea, kind of on the border of throwing up, which I held it together until I crossed the finish line, and then I went and sat down, and I was dizzy, and I eventually threw up everything that was in my stomach, and it was not fun. But you know what? At least now I know what that's like. You know, I've always heard about people getting nauseated when they run, and maybe I've kind of worried about that, but now, you know, I've been there, done that, and most likely it won't happen again, especially if I follow the advice of Gary here and not sip the stuff. What's interesting, though, is you use UCAN, Generation UCAN Superstarch for your marathons and your long runs, and you sip it.
I'm a sipper, and I don't know. I haven't had any problems yet, so.
Angie has an amazing stomach when it comes
Thank you.
Fueling during run. I think in everyday life, I can handle my food better than you, but when it comes to running and eating, you can handle it better than me.
I don't know. Your stomach is always like doing these weird growling type things. And your digestion is different.
Only when we podcast does my stomach start making funny noises.
But maybe your stomach starts, you know, misbehaving when you're nervous or something. Or
faint enough to not be recorded. Well, we're totally excited about having Dr. Noakes on this episode, and he is such a gracious man, really fun to talk to. We talked to him for an hour, and we had to break this into two parts because you're just going to see here in a moment just how packed with mind-blowing, I think I could really say this is mind-blowing stuff that he's going to talk to us about.
Yes, he's an incredibly well-learned man, a great scientist, and incredibly gracious, too.
Yes, so this episode we're going to talk about the central governor model for understanding fatigue in the body and exactly why it's so important to train yourself mentally to run a marathon and how to do that. And we'll also talk about his book, Waterlogged, and the dangers of hyponatremia, how you should really think carefully about your fluid intake during long runs and races.
Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way.
All right, we're on the podcast today with Dr. Tim Noakes. He is a professor of exercise and sports science at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. He's completed more than 70 marathons and ultra-marathons and is the author of the books Waterlogged, Running Injuries, Challenging Beliefs, and The Lore of Running. Dr. Noakes, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Trevor. It's a privilege to be on your program.
Just a quick anecdote. The very first book on running that I bought Angie was The Lore of Running, and I was in our local Barnes & Noble, and one of the managers came up to me and saw that I was looking for a book on running, and he said, you've got to get this. It is like the running Bible.
So. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks, Trevor.
And his recommendation was definitely spot on. I've used it over the years many, many, many times. I can't say I've read every single word, but I've definitely used it extensively for reference and gotten a lot of good content out of it. And I'm also reading your book, Challenging Beliefs, right now, and have used Waterlogged for reference as well. And so I'm very excited about those books as well.
Thank you, Angie. It's very kind of you to say those nice words about those books. Thank you.
Well, to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, what made you decide to devote yourself to studying exercise and sports science?
Trevor, I think it started because when I went to medical school in 1969, I started doing endurance sports for the first time in my life. I'd done the conventional sports, which are team sports in South Africa, typically cricket and rugby, and which, of course, neither of which are played to any extent in America. But that's what we do at schools. And then when I left and went to university, I decided to row, i.e. to do crew. Hmm. And it was then that I started running, and I just became mesmerized by what was happening to me as I became fitter and stronger and developed endurance. And a turning point was one of the professional coaches from Britain came out to South Africa. And one evening he gave us a lecture on the biology of rowing. And he said, you see, what happens is as you start rowing, your blood lactate levels are very low. But by the time you reach 1,000 meters in the race, your lactate levels are very high, and they just get higher and higher, and that's why you feel so terrible at the finish. And I was just mesmerized that here was some explanation of the biology which explained why I felt as I did. Of course, it's quite wrong. I don't believe that theory anymore, that the lactate is the cause of the discomfort and pain. But nevertheless, I remember walking out of that lecture thinking, that's what I want to study for the rest of my life. It was as simple as that. And the end result was that when I did my medical training, which we do in South Africa over 6 years, I just focused on sport and how it related to what I was learning. And the end result was that I had really little knowledge about the treatment of disease when I left medical school. I was interested in how you might prevent disease and particularly how you might treat sportsmen and athletes. And so that became my focus. And I was never particularly interested in conventional medicine. So when I qualified as a doctor, then I did my internship in the hospital, and that really convinced me that I wasn't a standard medical doctor. I had to do research, and I wanted to promote health and understand the physiology of exercise. And so the very next year after graduating and doing my internship, I went straight into research, and I've been in research since then. So that's since 1976, I've been involved in research and teaching. And it's been a fascinating ride because it's just been fascinating learning so much stuff. And I think I was really fortunate because the 1968 Olympics were the pivotal turning point in exercise science, because up to 1968, exercise science really couldn't explain very much. It was very traditional taught, and And then what happened was the Olympics were held in Mexico City, and all of a sudden the Americans and the Swiss and the Germans and other countries wanted to discover what was going on when you competed at altitude. So they sent athletes and their doctors to study them at altitude. And that became the first sort of applied physiology, modern, high-quality physiology applied to sport. And from that moment, sports science and sports medicine really took off. It was also helped by the arrival of the East Germans. And, of course, they did very well. They started in the 68 Olympics. By the 76 Olympics, they were doing incredibly well. And this just fired up, particularly the United States, but other countries, Australia, England, to try to understand why they'd done so well. And that put more interest in applied exercise science. And so when I started in exercise science in 1969, it was really possible to know the whole field because it was so small. But now, of course, it's become very, very specialized. It's not possible to know that anymore. But I think that's why I was very fortunate that I was an athlete. I studied medicine. I studied science. And I studied at the time when sports science was just starting to become a powerhouse in the world science.
And about the same time, you started running long distance as well and did the Comrades Ultra Marathon and have had some success with that. Kind of tell us how that further developed your study of exercise science.
Yes, thank you very much. What I realized in time was that if you want to be successful in science, you must study something in your environment that's unique. And I knew that the Comrades Marathon was unique in the world at the time because it was a race that went over 56 miles. And it had, at the time I ran it, it had 2,000 runners, whereas most races of that distance had probably 100 runners. So I knew that this was important and started studying it already in the 1970s, probably 1976, I think we did our first studies. And that was long before the Ironman came along. I think the Ironman comes along in 1978, about 2 years later. And all of a sudden, that then drives further interest in ultra endurance exercise. But we already had a foot in the door, so to speak, because we understood what was going on when you ran for 56 miles. It's not as demanding as the Ironman triathlon, but at least we had an understanding of what was going on, and we were actively researching it. So that was, I started researching that, and the first money we ever got to do research, because that kind of drives your direction, was we were funded to study the effects of carbohydrates during exercise. And
wow.
Of course, I'm doing the opposite things now. But the first research funding we ever got was to develop a product, a carbohydrate product for use during exercise. And we did, in fact, produce the very first goo for use during ultramarathon races. And I was one of the very first to run a race just sucking on a goo almost the whole way. And it wasn't very good for my health in the long term, but that's how we started. And we then did a lot of studies on metabolism during exercise and how carbohydrates affected it. And we did some really high quality research in those days. And that really was our first good research that we did in the early 1980s when I was still very much a fledgling scientist. That kind of gave me confidence that we could do good research, even though the work I did, I wouldn't repeat it again or do something.
So do you feel like more high quality studies with endurance runners come really from the field as opposed to from the laboratory?
That's a brilliant question. And the answer probably is yes, because it's very difficult to recreate those conditions in the laboratory. It's difficult to get athletes to exercise for more than about 3 hours in the laboratory. We have done one study where we got guys to do 7 hours in the laboratory, but it is so boring and so tedious that it's very difficult for them to provide a maximum performance, which they do every time they do an ultra endurance race. So yes, the answer is it's, in a sense, it's better to study those people in the field if you can. But of course, you can't study very much if you're studying them in the field.
Right. You don't want to hinder their race performance.
Yeah, precisely right. Yeah.
So you've done some great work on the central governor model for understanding fatigue in the body. For those who've never heard of it, could you tell us what is the central governor model?
Well, when I started in the sports sciences, we were taught as dogma or gospel that when you get tired, it's because your muscles produce too much lactic acid. and the lactic acid then poisons the muscles, and you feel terrible because of the pain coming from the lactic acid affecting the muscles. But most importantly, they poison the muscles, and you can't go any faster, so you have to slow down. And the part of that argument is that when we put an athlete on a treadmill or a bicycle and make them cycle or run faster and faster and faster, they reach a point at which, although they can go just a little bit faster or harder, they don't consume any more oxygen. And we did our early studies, and fortunately, we were so poor, we had to manufacture our equipment. We had the cheapest equipment that we could buy, and it was all put together, a very Heath Robinson approach. But we could never find the so-called plateau phenomenon, where the oxygen consumption reached a plateau and didn't rise any further, although the athlete could run further. And we did find it in a few cases, but in very few athletes, at least 80% of our athletes, when they stopped, their oxygen consumption was still rising. And then we studied rats, and we had more sophisticated equipment on them. And we never, ever found one rat that stopped running when its oxygen consumption plateaued. So we'd had two models. And I thought, well, if it's not the oxygen that's limiting, what could possibly be limiting? And in 1996, I had to give a lecture at the American College of Sports Medicine. And by then, I had decided that it was the brain which was controlling the muscle function in some way. And I didn't actually know how it was, and I got it completely wrong. But for the first time, I said that the brain is regulating exercise performance. And I drew strength from the reason that people don't die during exercise, and that has to be important. I say most people don't die. In other words, when you exercise, you remain in balance. However stressful it is, however hot it is, however high the altitude is, you don't usually die. Most people finish the exercise properly. So I said there must be a regulator that's regulating performance. And so we said it was in the brain. The article drew a lot of criticism from two Americans from the University of Tennessee. And they wrote a response, which was published next to my paper. And I didn't actually know it had been published until I saw it. That wasn't warned that it was there, which was quite unusual. You normally get warned. And when I read the article, I said, okay, I must read more carefully the original 1924 studies. And there in the 1924 studies, I found the kind of piece of information that I needed, because in that work written by the British Nobel laureate A.V. Hill, he had said the heart fails and then the muscles fail. And he said, to prevent the heart damaging itself, you have a governor, either in the brain or the heart, that slows the functioning of the heart, and that then slows the functioning of the muscles. And because I trained in cardiology, I knew that that's not the way it works. The way you control the work of the heart is by controlling the work of the muscles. So if you want to protect the heart, you must slow the work of the muscles down. And then I saw it. I realized the governor works by controlling how much muscle work you're able to do. And if you get into trouble, it slows down the work of the muscles. And then some of my colleagues came along and said, added the next bit, which was that fatigue is purely a sensation. It's an emotion. It's got nothing to do with what's actually happening in your body. And it's got lots to do with how close you are to the finish of the race. So the brain uses this emotion of fatigue to keep you within a safe pace as you run a long race.
I really think that's fascinating. So it's kind of like the brain is a computer that's constantly monitoring the levels in your muscles, pretty much, you know, kind of taking the temperature of your whole body and taking into account everything that it knows, you know, whereas the length of the race and how much glycogen you have, everything, and then it kind of will give you that emotion and regulate your pace that way. Is that kind of what you're saying?
You hit it spot on. That's precisely what it is. And I think people are realizing now that that is the case. And the best evidence for it is that, firstly, most sports have an end spurt. You speed up at the end. So if you were exhausted and fatigued and your muscles were failing, you wouldn't be able to speed up at the end, but you do. And you do it by activating more muscle or recruiting more muscle, which says that the brain should be able to recruit more muscle, but for some reason it chooses not to until you get very close to the finish. So it's the certainty that you're going to finish which allows you to speed up at the end. So that's some of the best evidence to explain why this model has to work. And it's not, you have a pacing strategy that the brain works out in advance, and it updates exactly as you said, it updates it with every stride. Because with every stride, the brain has to answer the question, are you going to stop? Are you going to go the same speed, or are you going to speed up, or are you going to slow down? Those are the four questions the brain must answer with each stride. And it does that. And eventually the things, you get tired, or whatever changes, and you slow down, and then you get closer to the end, and you go and you speed up. And you speed up by using more of the tired muscles that allows you to speed up.
I find this really fascinating because I've experienced that at the end of a marathon. You know, you think your legs can't go any further, and then you see the finish line, and it's like adrenaline shoots through your body, and you speed across the finish line and think, wow, I really had a lot left that I didn't know was there. So talk about mental training. If you're trying to get a personal best, how important is mental training to go along with the physical training that you're doing so that your central governor is, where you want it to be?
Well, I think all physical training in the end comes down to mental training in the sense that, of course, you do adapt your body. But the interesting biology is that if you train the same way every day after about 2 months, that's it. You don't change anymore. Your adaptations are fully adapted. You don't make any more new adaptations. That's my interpretation of the literature. The only thing that you can change is your perception of what you can do. And I think that's what happens. And so the reason why you train, and the reason why if you're running for a marathon, you go and train long runs on a Saturday or a Sunday morning, is to make sure, to convince your brain that you can do it. And I think that's ultimately what happens, that the harder you train, the ultimately you begin to believe that you can do it. And so that your performance is slightly better in the race because you've already done it in a sense in training. And I think that, at all training has an emotional component that is terribly, terribly important. And of course you have to do the physical side. You have to prepare your muscles. You have to prepare your heart. You have to prepare everything else. But ultimately, it's preparing your mind that is the key component to your training.
So is there anything I can tell myself next time I'm out on the course running a marathon to help me get through better?
You know, Trevor, that's a really interesting question because when you have your best race, you don't even remember it. You just, it's like you're in a trance. And I think that's the state that you want to get into. And if it was so easy to get into it, we would do it all the time. But I don't know how you do it, but we seem to do it occasionally, and then we have these amazing performances. So my best marathon, I don't remember the last 10Ks. I was so focused, and it wasn't painful. One of my students who's working with me currently is a medical doctor, and he's doing his PhD, but he's also a very good Ironman triathlete. And in one race, he found himself in second position. And he suddenly realized he was having an incredible race. And he says, for the rest of the race, for the whole run, he felt nothing. He felt no discomfort. And then he realized that the conscious acceptance that this was an amazing race, that he was doing unbelievably well, just obliterated all pain. And that's what he's studying. He's trying to explain, how is it that on some occasions you don't get any discomfort and you just feel fantastic and you have these incredible races and you can do things that you didn't think was possible. And we're looking for what's in the brain that produces those moments. But to answer your question, what I do know is if you ever ask the question, will I finish or how am I doing? Any negative statement, that's it. You've run your race. The moment a negative question arises or a negative feeling, that's it. So that's the one point. But the other point is that you don't ever have to listen to what your brain's saying to you because it's just making a story up. You don't have to listen to it. So it can tell you you're tired, but you can answer, no, I'm not tired because Dr. Noakes told me that it's you telling me I'm tired and I'm not really tired.
I like that.
Well, I know you've worked with a lot of elite athletes. What do they tell themselves when they're out there?
I'm not sure that they even have these questions. You know, I think that the very best athletes presume they're going to win.
Right.
And that's what they're focusing on all the time, that it's keeping the concentration going. I know two Kenyans that I spoke to recently, they said that the effort of running a marathon is so intense. It is just unbelievable that it's the mental concentration that really at the end of the day is what it's all about. In other words, they see the mental effort as being greater than the physical effort, the mental concentration, and not letting go at any moment. That's what's critical.
This has been awesome. Well, let's talk about a new subject here. We've just recently got your book Waterlogged, and when I first saw the book, I'm like, wow, an entire book on drinking water, you know?
Or not drinking water.
But then when, Angie began to read it and tell me what was in there, you know, I saw the wisdom behind, you know, why this message needed to get out. So for those of us who have not read the book or people in our audience who haven't heard of Waterlogged, could you kind of tell us the premise behind it?
Yeah, Trevor, in May 1981, I wrote an article saying that you must drink as much as you can. Any fluid you can get on a marathon race, please, you must either drink it, and if you can't drink it, you put it over your body. And that was 1981. And started actually when I started running marathons, there was no fluid available. You had to provide your own personal fluids. And I remember the first marathon I ran, we had a seconding station at 32 kilometers because the timekeepers were there. And I think they were there just to make sure you were running on the course. I think there was kind of a little bit of water there, but that was it. If you ran, and if you didn't come with someone to provide you with water, you didn't get water. And I remember in that race I was running, and it had rained the night before, and we were running, and there was a pool of water next to in the field, and it was all muddy. And the runner in front of me just rushed into the water and started lapping it up.
Wow.
And I thought, no, that water's a little bit too dirty for me. But So then, in fact, my first campaign was to make sure fluid was available to runners. And in South Africa, it was so successful that by 1981, in the 56-mile Comrades Marathon, when I ran it for the first time, there were no seconding stations. You had to provide everything yourself, and you were not allowed to drink for the first 30 kilometers. So we ran for the first 20 miles. You weren't allowed to drink because you weren't allowed to receive anything from your second. And what would happen? So you ran to 30 kilometers, 20 miles, and then he could see you, so you'd have a drink. And by then you might drink 500, a couple of hundred ml. And then you'd say, go 10 kilometers, go 8 miles or 5 miles further up, and I'll see you. And you may or may not see him. So I would probably saw my guy 4 or 5 times during the race, and that was it. So we probably drank 2 liters, 3 liters, not very many ounces of fluid. But that was 1973. By 1981, so successful had our campaign been that they had a drinking station every mile for 56 miles. So we had 56 drinking stations.
Wow.
And in that year, for the first year, a lady finished the race. Sorry, she got to 70 kilometers, about 40-odd miles. And her husband, she didn't recognize her husband. And he said, fine, you're too sick to continue. And he pulled her out the race, very fortunately. And he took her to the finish, and the doctors looked at her and said, oh, you're obviously dehydrated. You didn't drink enough. So they gave her 2 additional liters of fluid intravenously, and she got worse. She didn't get better. And the husband said, well, these doctors, maybe they're going to kill us. For he took her out and drove her to the hospital, which was now where the race had started. So it was 56 miles away. And halfway there, she had an epileptic seizure and went unconscious. Mm. And she was unconscious for 4 days. Now, fortunately, she was treated by a doctor who was properly trained. And he didn't assume anything. He didn't assume that she was dehydrated or whatever. But he looked at the clinical picture, did some blood measurements, and he measured her blood sodium concentration, and it was very, very low. Normally 140, in her case, was 112. So it had dropped 28 units. Now, that's massive. To drop 28 units, you really have to work at it. Anyway, so she survived, fortunately, because she could have died, but she recovered after 4 days. And about a week later, she wrote to me and she said, Dr. Noakes, what happened? She said, I dropped my blood sodium concentration. And coincidentally, the doctors had said, if you'd taken more salt during the race, you would have been fine. And she said, was that the case? And I said, I've absolutely no idea, because the condition had never been described in an athlete, in any sport, in any kidney conditions. And I started then researching it and managed to find one other athlete at that race who'd had the same problem. And then I found two other athletes who'd had the problem either in an Ironman or in the Comrades. And we looked at that and I spoke to them at length and I investigated them and I concluded that they'd all drunk too much. And so then we proposed in a paper in 1985 that these people had become waterlogged and were suffering from water intoxication. And we published that paper in 1985. And then by 1987, in the 1987 race, the Comrades, they had about 20 or 30 people. And I was phoned at midnight. I was in Cape Town, and that race is 2,000 kilometers away from home. And I was phoned in the middle of the night by the doctor saying, "Dr. Noakes, I've got 30 athletes here, all with low blood sodium concentrations. They look terrible. What must I do?" I said, "Just don't give them fluids." I said, "I knew that. Give them a diuretic. Just get them passing urine and they'll be fine." And then I realized we had to do a study. So the next year, I sent one of my PhD students up who was studying the kidney function in athletes. And he hospitalized eight sickest patients. And he measured exactly how much fluid they lost during recovery and how much sodium. And he showed that it was fluid overload that caused the problem. And it wasn't anything to do with sodium. So we published that paper. It took some time to get it published. But in 1991, we published the paper. And I was convinced that's the end of the problem because we'd solved it. We know it's overdrinking. And if you tell athletes to overdrink and don't warn them about this problem, they will get it. And I predicted that particularly in females, there would be deaths unless women running slowly in marathons were warned not to overdrink. And tragically, the opposite happened. The sports drink industry got into the act. They started suggesting that the more you drank, the faster you would run. The American College of Sports Medicine brought out new drinking guidelines in 1996 saying that you should drink as much as tolerable. That's the exact words they said.
Wow.
Yeah, and they said up to 1.2 liters per hour or 40 ounces of fluid per hour. And no one noticed, as I wrote in Waterlogged, that the 1.2 liter rule came from a study of elite athletes cycling very hard in very hot conditions. And tragically, that information was applied to slow women running in cold conditions in the United States. And they were told to drink the same amount of fluid, which is ridiculous. And tragically, deaths occurred as a consequence of that.
Yeah, I see people at marathon stations, you know, guzzling 2-3 glasses of water or sports drink at a time. And I'm guessing that probably at every station, they think they have to drink that much.
That's exactly right. And that's when this epidemic of hyponatremia or water intoxication or becoming waterlogged happened. And tragically, it wasn't recognized. And when these patients go to the medical doctors, if they think they're dehydrated, they will give them fluid. And that's a death sentence in this condition.
I was going to say that you advise people to drink to thirst. Is that going to be including waters with electrolytes, plain water, and sports drinks if they choose to use those? Would it be a combination of all those, or does water with electrolytes absorb differently? I'm just kind of curious about that.
Sure. Well, the industry spent a lot of money trying to prove that if it's got electrolytes in it, it's different. The fluid is different than water. But the reality is it isn't, because your intestine adds the sodium, or the pancreas adds the sodium. So if you drink water or you drink a sports drink, the rate of absorption is exactly the same because the sodium content will be the same. It's true that the glucose might make a small difference to it. So if you had a glucose-containing sports drink, it might be absorbed slightly more rapidly, but it's completely irrelevant because the rates of absorption are way ahead of your needs. The what limits you is how much you can actually drink. That's what limits your rate of restitution of fluids. In any case, you very seldom need to drink more than about 10 ounces an hour. That's about what you need. 10 fluid ounces per hour is usually more than adequate for most conditions, and certainly for people running slowly at the back of marathon races. So, but to get back to your point, you're quite right. All the evidence shows that drinking to thirst maximizes performance. And we have some athletes who will finish an Ironman triathlon having lost 12% of their body weight, and they will be fine. And there will be others who will drink to thirst and only lose 2% of their body weight and be performing well. And I believe it's your different biology. We're each unique. And if you are designed to finish the Ironman having lost 12% of body weight, but you finish having overdrunk and only lost 2% of your body weight, your performance will be impaired. Similarly, if you're meant to only finish at 2% and you finish at 12%, your performance will be impaired. And I think we forget this huge individual variability.
And
we need to drink to thirst, because that's what the science says at the moment. There's very little research, I admit that, but all the evidence shows that when you drink to thirst, you optimize your performance.
So the time when a person needs to figure out what drinking to thirst means for them is during their training. They can kind of get an average of what they usually drink, you know, per hour or whatever, and kind of apply that same principle possibly to the race.
Yes, I think that I get concerned when people start worrying about volumes, because then they start drinking to those volumes. The answer is, if you run a race and it's cold and windy and wet, you probably will require less to drink that on that day than it's a really hot, humid day. You might need to drink a lot more. So I think that's critical, that the environment does influence how much you want to drink. And so you can't factor that in from what you did in pre-training. So I think people need to just know that you run, and when you're thirsty, you drink, which is what most of us do in training. We'll run for an hour and stop at a cafeteria and drink, or we'll find a water tap somewhere and after about half an hour, an hour, and drink. And that's the way I've always run. And when I train over 2 hours, I don't drink in training. And in races, I do the same. If I might drink once an hour or twice every 2 hours, but that's my body's designed to do that. And I think that's the way you work it out.
That's good to know. So what about the athletes who think they need to add extra salt to their food so that their electrolyte levels stay in balance?
Well, if they were to check their urine, they'd find that they're just passing all that extra salt in urine. Jerome Conn, who was one of my great heroes, did some fabulous work in the 1940s, and it's fully described in Waterlogged. And he had a group of conscientious objectors working with him, and these guys were incredibly motivated because they felt guilty that they weren't fighting the war. So he said, fine, I'm going to make you as if you were at war, and you're going to do 6 hours work a day, and you're going to do 6 hours exercise in the heat. So that's what he did, and he trained every day. They went out and exercised for 6 hours in his heat box, and he changed how much salt he gave them. And they would start the experiments taking about 16 to 20 grams of salt a day, which is about twice what we do, and eventually cut it down to about 2 grams of salt per day. And they stayed in perfect salt balance, whether they were eating 20 grams or 2 grams per day, because the body has this incredible capacity to conserve sodium, largely because humans were created or evolved, whichever you choose, in a very hot environment where there was little salt around. The only salt we had was in the bodies of the animals that we killed. And so because we were internal, because we were away from the sea where all the salt was. So we had very little access to salt. So we became incredibly good at conserving salt. And our environment has changed completely now, because we've got so much salt in the environment that we spend most of our time trying to get rid of it. So that's the key. If people want to add salt to their foods, that's fine. But they don't really need to, because it's just coming out in the urine, and they will see it on their skin as well. The sports drink industry also were culpable, in my view. They said, if you find salt on your skin, that means you're a salty sweater. You must eat more salt. That's completely wrong. The reason why you have salt on your skin is because you're taking so much salt and the body's trying to excrete it. So the input, the how much you ingest of sodium determines your output. And the more you ingest, the more you will put out.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Tim Noakes. And I'm sure you agree with us that he is a wealth of scientific knowledge And also, his voice is such that maybe it's because he has that South African accent, but I could listen to this guy talk all day.
I could too.
He's very, very considerate and just very wise and whimsical. And anyway, we thought that this would be a good place to end. This is only about half of our conversation, and we want to bring him back on the next episode, and we'll play the rest of that conversation. We're going to talk specifically about his nutrition philosophy and how he's changed his nutrition philosophy, going from a high carbohydrate diet approach to a low carb, high fat diet approach, which we've been doing also, as many of you probably know. So that'll be next episode, and you'll enjoy that. But Angie, what did you think about our conversation on the central governor? It's almost hard to believe that fatigue would be an emotional state and not a physical state in the body.
Yeah, it's definitely amazing how our feelings can affect our physical state. It really goes hand in hand, I believe.
So what do you think you do, Angie, to train yourself mentally for these races?
Well, I've always known that it's important to have a positive mantra and some kind of positive mental flow going on during a race.
Yeah.
Because I've experienced the times when those negative thoughts take hold and your performance really does suffer. And so just having that strong mind and giving yourself positive feedback is so important. So I think I really try to work on my mental game during races. Mm-hmm. Am I always successful? No. I've definitely let myself get mentally defeated before, you know, kind of dropping from my ideal goal to a good enough goal and things like that.
Yeah.
But I think it's a process for every single runner. And hopefully the more races you do and the more experience you get, the stronger you'll become mentally and able to really know what your body is capable of.
Do you have a mantra going into the Myrtle Beach Marathon?
No, I don't. Not yet.
Well, hopefully you'll think of one.
Yes.
Because I've thought of a pretty good one.
Oh, really?
I thought of it today, actually, and I think I'm going to try to use this. Going back to the story of Pheidippides, my mantra is, run like a naked Greek champion.
What? It's kind of disturbing, actually. Wow.
I thought you'd like that.
I'm stunned.
I mean, imagine, though, if you had to run naked like they did back in the Olympics, you know, in the Roman Empire.
I think I'd run a lot faster, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, could be a good mental strategy, wouldn't you say?
It could be.
Well, we also talked about hyponatremia, drinking too much water, and you've got the book Waterlogged. Have you finished reading it?
No, not yet. It's rather long.
Yes. The Lore of Running is like 900 pages. You should get your money's worth that.
Yes,
books.
You do.
You think that when you first started running that you were drinking too much water? Or how has this progressed for you? I mean, a lot of people are just out there running their marathons for the first time, not even knowing how much water they are supposed to drink or what the rules are when it comes to that, don't you think?
I think so. When I first started doing my marathon training, I didn't really know anything. And I think I did pretty well drinking to thirst. However, then I started reading some information about staying well hydrated, and I think I kind of swung possibly in the direction of, you know, overhydrating for a while. Now I think as time has gone on, I've kind of come back to a more drink to thirst and the conditions type of moderation approach.
There's got to be a difference between drinking to thirst and drinking to a dry mouth, because I have a dry mouth when I run. It doesn't necessarily mean I need to drink water, though, does it?
Yes, exactly. And some people will chew gum or suck on a mint or something to help prevent that dry mouth feeling.
That's a good idea. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And Angie's going to tell you about a company that sends out a gift box with running goodies in it to you or to the runner in your life. And we actually got one of these things in the mail.
Well, I did. And then you confiscated all the stuff.
Yes, Angie got one, but then I ate all the stuff inside of it.
Yes, my coaching client Taylor sent me a runner box for Christmas, and it was just a really kind gesture, and it was very fun to receive this stuff.
Yeah.
And basically, it's a subscription-based box for runners or triathletes, and it's a mini shoe box that's filled with running products that gets mailed directly to whatever address you choose, and it has everything from energy products, you know, gels, chews, protein supplements, nutrition bars, skincare, other accessories, just kind of a hodgepodge of newer products that are out there. And it's kind of a fun way to be able to try new things without having to invest money in, you know, buying a whole pack. So if you're looking for a great gift for a runner or somebody that's hard to buy for who's an athlete, check out Runnerbox, and they're found at therunnerbox.com.
And if you'd like more information on running and marathon training, you can find all kinds of helpful blog posts and articles over at marathontrainingacademy.com, as well as our other podcast episodes. We also have resources over there like training plans, our vintage podcast episodes, Angie's ebook, and of course our premium content in the Academy, where we have courses that empower people to train for a marathon the right way and prevent injury and burnout and to set PRs and take their fitness to the next level. We appreciate all of you listening to this episode. We hope that you'll have ultimate success in your running and marathon training this year. We believe that running a marathon is a life-changing experience. At least we have found it to be. And we are glad to help you on your journey. Remember, you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Run on my way, run on my way.